An uphill battle awaits Nigeria's new president. Nigeria's new government will assume office when the country is grappling with deteriorating economic conditions and widespread insecurity. The outgoing government of President Muhammadu Buhari tried to respond to the security crisis by increasing defense spending as well as the deployment of the military. The government has also rolled out important security sector and criminal justice system reforms. This includes the review of the Police Act, the creation of a presidential roadmap on police reform, and the establishment of a trust fund to train better and equip the police force. However, the situation has continued to concern communities under persistent threats of attack from armed groups in different parts of the country. The new president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, will have to confront this complicated web of insecurity. What can he do differently or focus more on? Hello, welcome to The Crisis Room, a podcast from Human Angle. I'm Hawassa Al-Abbakar and I'm here with my colleague Murtala Abdullahi. In this podcast, we look at crisis trends across the country and answer the tough questions around them. This week, we're here with a guest, Chidi Iwanu, a defense expert with Pekavi Consult. Good day, Chidi. Welcome to The Crisis Room.
Good morning. How are you doing?
The security situation in Nigeria has appeared to be uncontrollable, considering the incidents that we continue to see over the years, despite all these investments, as we mentioned, in military equipment and also in the security sector. What do you think is the problem?
Well, the key problem that we would deduce from the Nigerian security situation, if we're going to distill it into, maybe one, kind of key significant issue is governance. So the political kind of leadership of Nigeria is problematic, and if we keep on focusing on buying equipment or expanding troops without fixing what is the root cause of all our problems, which is good governance and political leadership, then we kind of miss the point. To make that point, we need to look at what security problems Nigeria faces. The big ones: Boko Haram, ISWAP, unknown gunmen, IPOB, BSN in the southeast, nomadic bandits, and kidnappers and things like that. None of these are external problems. We're not talking about a problem like Ukraine and Russia, a country fighting each other across the border. We're not talking about a problem maybe like Colombia, Venezuela, or any of these countries that, or Armenia and Azerbaijan. These are all internal problems to Nigeria that would not even have got to the point of, a violent insurgency if there had been good governance. And even now that they're violent insurgents, if we had good governance, rule of law, they would have been tempered quite a bit. So before we talk about weapons, equipment, numbers of troops, we need to, focus on the big elephant in the room, which is that poor governance in Nigeria is what creates these problems and is what makes them metastasize and what makes them continue. And without addressing that issue, all we're doing is firefighting.
Wow. Actually, your thoughts reflect the complexity of the problem at hand. And also, like you mentioned, some of the stuff that I was going to ask you for my next question is like, do you consider the next president's priority to be about equipment, manpower, or reforms, or both?
It's all of the above, but if you're going to put them in a list of priorities, the first thing he needs to do is address what I said in the beginning, which is political the political will and political leadership. Now whether irrespective of what's going on right now with the election petitions or whatever it is, we need to go with what's on the ground, which is that Bola Ahmed Tinubu has the certificate of return. And all things being equal, he's going to be Nigeria's next president. So we need to assume that, from the perspective of him being the next president, what should be his priority? Now, two things stand out. The first is, the way the campaigns were run, and obviously, the legacy of, the government that he's taking over from. So the campaigns were highly divisive. We obviously had for the first time, the big three of Nigeria competing against each other. And all the factors that have been used in the past from tribe to religion were weaponized during this election. And at the same time, you have the fact that the vast majority of Nigerians did not vote for him. So again, let's put aside what each side claims, whether the opposition claims it was rigged or not. We can only deal with what's presented to us. And the reality from what's presented to us is that the vast majority of Nigerians voted for other candidates, be it Atiku or the Labour Party. So he comes in even all things being equal, as you know, a minority president who didn't win the popular vote, but he's, you know, still, you know, as the president according to the rules. So the first thing one would need to do is unify that, you know, the political class and unify the regions. That needs a lot of, you know, the concrete statement that was used, you know, a lot during the election, a lot of bridge building, a lot of reaching out, a lot of kind of compromises. And the problem we're going to have in Nigeria is that compromise and bridge building going to be the same as it was before, as in simply, you know, reaching out to one or two of the elites from the regions, giving them boosts and saying, okay, that's it. Or is it going to be something genuine? And then the second point, as I said, was, you know, the legacy of the last administration. Now, the last administration, you know, came in with, at the peak of, you know, an offensive, you know, being by the former one, under Jonathan, which kind of pushed back Boko Haram and then relaxed. And then we saw Boko Haram, you know, we take a lot of territory, cause a lot of problems. Now, towards the end of this 8 years, we're seeing Boko Haram has been defeated, or more or less defeated, by ISWAP and the military forces, and it's a one structure. But you've got ISWAP now. ISWAP is now, you know, quite strong in the Lake Chad Basin, is quite strong now in the Northwest, and it now has a relatively strong core in the North Central. So dealing with all of this now is going to be very complicated. It's going to be very difficult, not just about, you know, generating more troops, generating more platforms, you know, whether air or armor, whatever it is how you employ those troops. And then what happens at the end? Let's say you've taken the fight to the enemy, you defeated them, what happens next? You just leave that territory? And who then holds that ground for you? Is it the army? Is it the police? How long can we keep on using the army to do policeman's job? And then at the end of this conflict, what happens when we have a 500,000 man army? Do we demobilize it? What happens? These are the key questions that, a president now needs to start asking. How do we deal with what's in front of us now? What's going to happen to us, you know, in the medium term? What happens in the long term? And then finally, what happens after we win? You know, what do we do then? Big strategic questions, and they can't be answered by, you know, a single person. They definitely can't be answered in a sectional or partisan manner. It has to be answered in a nationalistic manner.
I think you nailed it when you really said big strategy questions. It's super important that those questions and answers, that we understand like what we need. And like, yeah, I also agree with you, the fact that a combination of these factors are required, whether in terms of equipment, manpower reforms, the notion that we'll just increase the size of the security forces, and that way we will address two issues like unemployment and also address insecurities, that does not actually take into consideration the importance of quality, building professionalism, proficiency, all these things matter. And what we have seen these days is that there are a lot of things that technology or equipment can help you do that you don't require manpower. And yeah, you also mentioned a very interesting point, really, in terms of like general broadly governance. When you do security operations, what happens there? How do you govern these areas? How do you get established the state presence? Broadly, how does governance help in terms of security, addressing these underlying issues? So we shouldn't just be focusing on the symptoms of the problem, but going down to the root. When we talk about security sector reforms, I guess we're looking at things, for example, like police tactics, techniques, and procedure alongside welfare. And the same thing across broad in terms of other law enforcement agencies.
So when we're looking at, you know, things like you know, the tactics training opportunities, TTPs, it's important that we look at it from a from the perspective of where we are and what phase we're working from. So it's all well and it's all well and good to look at, you know, whether it was used in the United Kingdom or the United States or Russia or China and say, oh well, that works there, it's going to work here. It's completely different because we're talking about a different population, a different culture, different education levels, different training facilities and resources, and also a different population that you're acting within. So the important thing in developing and redefining our TTPs is, first and foremost, understanding, you know, the two key audiences. The first audience is the security forces, the police, the army themselves, and the second key audience is the population that you're operating within. And then by looking at them, you know, both as, you know, independent kind of stakeholders, you should be able to define TTPs that work with them. So within the UK, there is it's policing by consent. So the police are not routinely armed. They generally, you know, deal with you from the perspective that they are your, you know, you are their employer, you are their customer. So they give you, you know, everything is policing by making sure everyone understands and is invested in the law and is ready to participate, you know, by virtue of, you know, being invested in the law. And the US is a different model. It's policing, it's a mixture of policing by consent, but also very much policing by force, where, you know, the police are armed, you know, everything is, you know, done, you know, from the point of view that the police, you know, are right and, you know, they're there to impose their will on you. And Nigeria, we took the colonial model, which was policing by force, which was essentially purely regime protection. We took it and we put it on steroids and it's gone crazy. We now need to look at that model and say, does it really work? You know, but at the same time, can we bring in something like policing by consent in Nigeria, where there's a lack of knowledge of the law, there's a lack of faith in the law, and a lack of adherence to the law? So when you think about things like that, it opens up more and more doors where you have to now talk about, well, before we talk about changing, you know, police or security forces, we need judicial reform. So that people believe that, okay, if I go to the police or if I'm arrested, I will have a fair trial. I will be able to get out without paying bribes. The system will look after me. Then people start believing in the system. You also need to then look at things like public education. You know, if people are familiar with the laws, how do we make sure they are? How do we make sure every child knows their rights and knows what you're meant to do under the law? How do we make sure that every adult knows the same thing? So you're looking at now, you know, kind of an information piece, a mass mobilization piece. And then once you've done all of that, or at the same time as you've done all of that, you then need to look at, as I said, the other audience, the training audience, the police, the security forces. The police culture, you know, is the problem. It's, you know, it's not just equipment. It's not, you know, it's the culture. The culture that police force is there to protect the regime, or, you know, whoever is in power, and also is there to protect itself and predate off the people. So until you change that culture to we're here to protect the people above everything else, and then educate people that this is what the police force is here for, then, you know, changing TTPs is pointless. You're just putting lipstick on a pig. You know, you're doing exactly the same thing over and over again, you know, with different, you know, bells and whistles and expecting a different result.
Yeah, it's really crystal clear that we need, like, broad and robust overhaul of the system. And as you said, the issue isn't just about a decade ago. It dates back to the concept, the colonial concept of police in Nigeria, and why we need to even just evolve and build a system that works. And actually, your suggestion, actually, I think it's like kind of the best. Like, we need to ensure that there's confidence in the system and people understand the law, obey the law. And it goes as simple as, like, people obeying the traffic light, even when there are no officers close by to enforce that, people obeying basic rules and other things. So I think broadly, like you said, the education system, the public awareness system, and then also strengthening institutions and ensuring that there's broader accountability and transparency, all these things revolve around having better security. Chidi, thank you very much for joining us.
Excellent, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
It seems like the task ahead wouldn't be an easy one. And from what we can clearly see here, there needs to be a fresh approach to addressing the symptoms and root causes. This is an episode of Human Angle Crisis Room. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode. The producer is Anthony Asemota. The executive producer is Ahmed Silkipak.